from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. How do you go from being Russia's biggest foreign investor to this?
I am genuinely Putin's number one foreign enemy, and they'd like to wipe me out one way or another.
That was American-born British financier Bill Browder. He was a driving force behind the Magnitsky Act, which allows the U.S. to sanction government officials suspected of corruption and human rights abuses. The law was also an alleged subject of the 2016 meeting between Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, and a Kremlin-connected Russian lawyer. Browder joins us to talk about his recent arrest in Spain on a Russian Interpol arrest warrant and what it's like being Putin's number one enemy. It's all next after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. He was once the Russia president's number one fan. Now he calls himself Putin's number one enemy, and he might be onto something. Last month, Bill Browder was arrested outside of his Madrid hotel room by Spanish authorities under an order from Russian Interpol. As the architect behind the Magnitsky Act, a U.S. law that places sanctions on corrupt officials, it was not the first time that Bill Browder came under fire by the Russian government. He joins us this hour to talk about how he went from being the largest foreign investor in Russia to being the country's biggest critic. And welcome, Bill Browder.
Great to be here.
Great to have you here. And this is quite a story, and I want our listeners to know as much about it as we can cover in this hour. But let's talk first about the fact that you, like I said, you were Putin's darling for a while, weren't you?
Well, so just a bit of background. I went to Russia to set up an investment fund in the early 1990s, as Russia was just breaking off and democratizing and becoming its own country. So I set up this investment fund. I lived in Moscow, and one of the things that happened at the very beginning of the whole Russian privatization program was that the previous president, Boris Yeltsin, had allowed 22 oligarchs to basically take 40% of the country and everybody else live in destitute poverty. And so professors were driving taxis, nurses were prostituting themselves, art museums were selling the paintings off the wall. And so I was watching this, and everyone else was watching this sort of deep humiliation of the Russian people. And so everybody was hoping and praying that some kind of normalcy would return. And when Putin came in to replace Yeltsin, his pitch to everybody was that he was going to get rid of the oligarchs. He was going to bring some normalcy back to the country and bring the country from its knees.
And to some extent, the oligarchs were in opposition to Putin, weren't they?
So what happened was, at the very beginning, the Russian oligarchs thought that Putin was their subordinate. And Putin didn't like that. And so when Putin said, I'm going to start taking out the oligarchs, I was cheering, and so was everybody else, for that matter. A lot of people won't admit it today, but anyway, I said, yeah, great, let's take those oligarchs out. And he actually took one of them out. He took the biggest oligarch out, this guy named Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who is the owner of the oil company Yukos, the richest oligarch. And I cheered that. I said, great, one down, 21 to go. And then the next oligarch, instead of taking him out, they paid him $13 billion for his oil company. And at that point, it looked like something was not.
At that
right.
point, we were on the way to kleptocracy under Putin, and something that certainly you experienced when they brought you up for tax fraud, and you were charged with tax fraud. But what was going on, to a large extent, was stealing money by the oligarchs and Putin.
Well, so what happened was after Putin arrested the richest guy, Khodorkovsky, the other oligarchs all were watching this on their yachts in the south of France and just terrified. They thought, oh, my God, I don't want to be that guy. And so so Khodorkovsky was arrested in the fall of 2003. And in the summer of 2004, or I should say in the fall of 2004, they all went to Putin and said, Vladimir, what do we have to do to make sure we don't end up in the same jail cell as Khodorkovsky? And Putin said, real simple, 50%. And I should point out, he wasn't saying 50% for the Russian government. He was, or the presidential administration of Russia. He was saying 50% for his own pocketbook. And that was the moment that Putin became the richest man in the world. And that was also the moment that anybody who was fighting corruption in the country was now at that point, was fighting Putin. And I had been fighting corruption in the country because it was completely messing up the business environment and my fund. And they didn't like that at all. And a whole series of things emerged. First, I was expelled from the country and declared a threat to national security. Second, my offices were raided by a bunch of corrupt police officers who seized all our documents. Third, they used all the stuff they got from us to do a massive $230 million tax rebate fraud, stealing the taxes that we paid. And when I started to complain and scream bloody murder, they then opened up a criminal case against me.
And arrested your tax lawyer, Magnitsky.
Well, and then Sergei Magnitsky, who had exposed the $230 million tax rebate fraud, the same officers who he exposed, who he testified against, came to his home at 8 in the morning on the 24th of November 2008. They arrested him. They put him in pretrial detention. And then the authorities then tried to started to torture him to get him to withdraw his testimony.
This is a story that's just so appalling, and you pretty much laid it out in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee and wound up, as a result, getting these sanctions and getting the Magnitsky Act passed, which I applaud you for. But the reality is that he was tortured and he was killed, really, wasn't he?
Sergei Magnitsky was tortured for 358 days. They put him in cells with 14 inmates and 8 beds and left lights on 24 hours a day to impose sleep deprivation. They put him in cells with no heating and no window panes in December in Moscow, so he nearly froze to death.
Forgive me, somebody may say, how do you know all this? He documented it all, didn't he?
Well, exactly. So Sergei, everybody has their own way of dealing with adversity. And Sergei's way, he was a lawyer's lawyer, and he wrote everything down in the form of criminal complaints. Every day, sometimes twice a day, he would write up a criminal complaint about his mistreatment in custody. And he would describe who was doing it to him, when they were doing it, how they were doing it, why they claimed they were doing it. And he wrote 450 of these things during his 358 days in detention, documenting everything that happened to him. And once a month or so, he would hand them to his lawyer. His lawyer would file them. The Russian authorities would ignore them or reject them. But we got copies. And because of that, we know exactly what they did to him. And what they did to him is the most horrific thing you could ever imagine. They tortured him. They slowly, slowly, over a 358-day period, sadistically tortured him.
This is consistent with Putin going after, even most recently, where in your hometown of London, going after his enemies the way he does. I mean, it goes all the way back to going after Bulgarians with umbrellas, but, we're talking about mainly Russians. You were in a kind of different situation, though. I mean, there was a little bit of concern. They wanted to get you in a Russian prison, clearly.
Well, Putin genuinely hates my guts, and you can see it when he's discussing me. If you watch him on TV, you can watch his body language. He's just so horrified by me because I've done something which truly I found his Achilles heel, which is after he and his regime tortured and killed Sergei Magnitsky, my lawyer, I came up with this idea, which was that all these guys like Putin and all of his cronies, they keep their money. They don't keep it in Russia. They keep it in the West. And I came up with this idea of seizing their assets in the West and banning their travel. And that became known as the Magnitsky Act. And the Magnitsky Act was originally passed in 2012. And it set Putin on a apoplectic frenzy of anger and retaliation. And so he's really, really upset about this because he spends his whole life stealing money in Russia, and then he wants to keep it safe in the West, and I've just put the safety of his money at risk.
And he also not only became apoplectic, but he decided to take away adoption of Russian children as a way of striking back, and that gets us right to the Trump Tower and Natalia Veselinskaya, who was a lawyer and essentially tied to Putin. And I mean, we can speculate all we want, but that was the meeting that Paul Manafort was at along with Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner, and it was supposed to be about adoption. At least that was the official story.
Well, so let's just be clear. Let's take one step back, and then we'll be clear. The Magnitsky Act passed in December of 2012, and in direct retaliation to the Magnitsky Act passing, Putin banned the adoption of Russian orphans by American families. And I should point out, these are not just regular orphans. These were sick orphans. Those are the only orphans they put up for adoption, is these as these poor children that had Down syndrome and HIV and all sorts of other horrible things. And the Americans would take them, and these children would be nursed back to health, and they would survive. And if they weren't adopted, they would die in Russian orphanages. And so Putin banned the adoption of Russian orphans by American families. And this set off a whole firestorm inside of Russia and outside of Russia. And so whenever anyone talks about adoption, as they were doing in this Trump Tower meeting, first of all, they weren't talking about adoption in the Trump Tower meeting. That was just a euphemism. What they're talking about is the Magnitsky Act. And specifically, the lawyer you're referring to is a female lawyer, Russian lawyer named Natalia Veselnitskaya. She works for a senior Putin regime crony, a person named Pyotr Kotsev, and this whole Trump Tower meeting was about basically Putin sending her to try to repeal the Magnitsky Act. And so they went to Trump Tower on June 9th, 2016. Natalia Veselnitskaya, a former Russian spy named Rinat Akhmetshin, and a couple other characters, and they sat down with Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, and Donald Trump Jr. And according to every single person in the meeting, the main agenda item was to repeal the Magnitsky Act. That's what they were asking for.
And let me jump ahead again. Let me jump backward first, though. I mean, part of the story is your story. I mean, you were handling an extraordinary amount of money, biggest fund, actually, investment fund, I believe, your Hermitage Capital in Russia, one of the biggest ones in the world. And your grandfather was Earl Browder, who was the head of the Communist Party in the United States.
Yeah, so my whole backstory is quite strange, and also was what drove me into this unique and unenviable position that I'm in right now, which is that my grandfather was indeed the head of the American Communist Party. In fact, before he was head of the American Communist Party, he had been recruited to come to Russia by the communists in the late 1920s. He was a labor union organizer. He went to Russia. He met a Russian girl who became my grandmother. My father was born in Moscow. And then 5 years later, he was sent back to America to head the American Communist Party. He ran for president on the communist ticket twice against Roosevelt. He was imprisoned and then pardoned. And then eventually he was, for Stalin's liking, he was too much of a capitalist, and they expelled him from the Communist Party in 1945. And then, but that didn't seem to help him during the 1950s, during the McCarthy era, and he was viciously persecuted. So I was born in 1964. I'm 54 years old. And when I was going through my teenage rebellion in the 1970s, I was trying to figure out a great way to rebel from this family of communists. And then I came up with this perfect idea, which was...
Your father and mother were communists? Or?
Yeah, my father was a professor.
At Berkeley for a while.
Oftentimes at Berkeley. He was mainly at the University of Chicago. He was a mathematician. And I don't think I've ever met a professor that's on anywhere right of center. And he certainly wasn't. He was a very left-wing professor. And so I had this family of left-wingers and communists and academics and so on. And I wanted to do something which would really upset them when I was a teenager. And so I put on a suit and tie and became a capitalist, and that absolutely upset them. And it took them many decades to get over it.
Well, you talk about how sore Putin is at you. You had your own family pretty sore at you. Talking to Bill Browder, by the way, he's here with us in studio. He was still CEO of Hermitage Capital Management, also the author of the 2015 book, Red Notice, A True Story of High Finance, Murder, and One Man's Fight for Justice. And let's talk about red notices, because you just came off of one in Spain. I mean, there have been 6 arrest attempts on you from Putin, right?
So Putin is mad. He's mad at the Magnitsky Act, and he's mad at me for being the principal architect of the Magnitsky Act. And Putin is a guy who never allows things to just lie. If he's mad, he gets back. And in my case, what he decided to do was, the first thing he did after the Magnitsky Act was passed was he put me and Sergei Magnitsky, my lawyer who was murdered, on trial in July of 2013. So just let me make this clear. They put a dead man on trial 3 years after they killed him.
And you were in absentia.
And I was in absentia. I was in London. So we were both on trial. There was a courtroom with a judge and prosecutors and defense attorneys and court reporters and press. and a cage, which was empty, where the defendants were supposed to sit. They found us both guilty. They couldn't do anything more than they having killed Sergei Magnitsky. They sentenced me to 9 years in absentia in a Russian prison. And in that process, that was the first attempt that they tried to have me arrested abroad through Interpol. Russia, like every other country, is a member of Interpol. Interpol is the international police organization. And Russia has an opportunity as a member to go and issue a warrant for arrest for anyone they want. And they issued a warrant for my arrest. And this put Interpol in a terrible position because Interpol is supposed to be a crime-fighting organization, not an organization working for criminals like Vladimir Putin going after their victims. And so Interpol did the right thing, and Interpol declared that the arrest warrant was invalid, that it was politically motivated and shouldn't be acted on. And that was the Russians' first attempt. And normally when someone gets slapped down like that, that's the end of the story. But about 6 weeks after their first attempt, they made a second attempt. And Interpol immediately responded saying, again, illegitimate, politically motivated, don't act on it. And okay, maybe that's the end of the story. But no, Russia has gone four more times since then. And the last time was 13 days ago. I was in Madrid in Spain. I was there to meet with the chief anti-corruption prosecutor of Spain to help investigate the Magnitsky case as it led to Spain, because there was money flowing to Spain. And there was a knock at my door in my hotel in Madrid. And outside the door was the hotel manager and two police officers who asked for my ID. I provided it. They compared it to the piece of paper they had. And they said, Mr. Browder, you're under arrest. And I said, why? And they said, Interpol, Russia.
And then you found yourself in the car, right? And actually sending out pictures from that car, not knowing where you were going or what police station even you could be put in and possibly even going to be turned over to the Russians. I mean, you must have been terrified.
Well, so first of all, I had an interesting opportunity, which was the general manager of the hotel was a bit embarrassed that this was happening, and he pleaded with the police officers to allow me to gather my belongings. And so while I was gathering my belongings, I put out the first tweet saying, urgent, arrested on a Russian Interpol arrest warrant in Madrid. And that set Twitter on fire. I've got a lot of followers. There's a lot of journalists, a lot of politicians watching what's happening to me, and they saw this and it all. And then the police officers hadn't taken away my phone, and so I was able to snap a picture from the back of the police car. And again, that continued to sort of fuel the fire. And at this point, my main concern was that these weren't really police officers. That these were guys dressed up as police officers, and that they were a Russian working for Russia, and they would drive me out to an airstrip on the outskirts of Madrid, put me onto a Gulfstream, and next thing I know, I'm in Moscow. And they didn't help alleviate that concern, because as we were driving to the police station, instead of going to the police station, we stopped at some nondescript building in the center of old Madrid, and they made me get out of the car, and I said, "What are we doing?" And they said, medical checkup. I said, what do you mean medical checkup? I'm not going to any medical checkups. That's ridiculous. And they said, it's part of the protocol. And I said, I want to speak to my lawyer. They said, you can't speak to your lawyer. I said, I want to speak to my lawyer. I'm not going for any medical checkup. And we had this standoff standing outside this building for about 10 minutes. They were making phone calls. And they eventually gave up on this whole medical checkup idea, put me back into the police car, and then we arrived at the police station. And for me, that was the moment that I knew I was safe, because once I was in a normal police station, I don't think the Russians would get to me.
And what do you think that medical checkup was all about? Was that just protocol, or maybe they had received some money from the Russians to... I mean, one of the problems with Magnitsky was he was in jail all that time, needed medical care. He didn't get any medical care.
Well, I mean, I wasn't in any kind of illness, and so I don't know what this medical checkup was all about. My fear was that I was going to walk into some building and someone was going to inject me with something, and then all of a sudden I was going to be, you know, completely out of it, and then they could put me into a container and send me out of this country. So I was definitely not going to go in for that medical checkup. I have no idea. I mean, these people seemed to be legitimate policemen, and they took me to a legitimate police station. And once I was there at the police station, and by the way, it was kind of interesting, because I don't think they have that many international fugitives at this particular police station. And so everyone was sort of popping their head in, all excited to take a look at me seeing this international fugitive or whatever. And then they put in the call to Interpol to say, we got the guy. We got your guy. There was a warrant. We got him. What should we do with him? And it was quite interesting to feel the mood of the police station, because about an hour later, Interpol called back and said, release him. And everyone was really deflated. They thought they had gotten the guy, and all of a sudden I was being released.
We're talking about Browder, and it's quite a story that he has to tell, especially even in many ways most recently in Spain. We're updating that. Also, I want to update something else with you, but let me give out the phone number first and invite you, our listeners, to join us if you have questions or comments for our guest. We do welcome your involvement in the program, and you can join us now at our toll-free number. The number to call, 866-733-6786. We welcome your call, so please feel free to be part of the program. Again, 866-733-6786 is the number. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page, but we certainly welcome your involvement. And again, Bill Browder is CEO and co-founder of Hermitage Capital Management, author of Red Notice, A True Story of High Finance, Murder, and One Man's Fight for Justice. We were talking in the last hour, I don't know if you heard any of it, Bill, about the World Cup, and the name Robbie Williams came up, and you've been outspoken about that. You feel that he shouldn't necessarily open the ceremony at Putin's World Cup site?
Well, so here's a guy who's beloved by many, and many people who don't particularly spend their time thinking about anything other than music. And he's going to go there to Moscow at Vladimir Putin's invitation, being paid a lot of money to legitimize Vladimir Putin and his regime. And I find that to be totally unacceptable. I think that this man is effectively selling his soul to legitimize a dictator. And it's that he has full freedom not to do it. He's a very wealthy man. He doesn't need the money. He shouldn't be there legitimizing Vladimir Putin.
And we're coming up on a break, but we just have a president who has legitimized Kim Jong-un in North Korea, and we have a president who arguably has been legitimizing Vladimir Putin because he's never criticized him. The sanctions are back in place and so forth, but we haven't heard anything really negative or critical about Putin specifically, and the president seems to admire him.
Well, this is a very complicated story because you're right. Trump says the most offensive things to me, praising Putin. I mean, Putin is a cold-blooded sociopathic killer and nothing else. And for Trump to be saying nice things about him is unacceptable. However, his government, his administration, has been absolutely tough on Russia. And I'm a very, very I'm the biggest connoisseur of the toughness.
It's the first time I've heard connoisseur used that way. Well, we're going to come back and talk with you some more about this and talk with our listeners. And again, if you'd like to join us, if you have questions or comments for Bill Browder, we welcome your involvement in the program. Toll free, you can join us now at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. And you're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Bill Browder, who is the CEO of Hermitage Capital Management, and the author of a book which is still out and available called Red Notice, A True Story of High Finance, a Murder, and One Man's Fight for Justice. And that fight for justice took him, as I said earlier, to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And there was a great deal of help, I was just mentioning this off air, from Senators McCain and Cardin in terms of really moving forward with the sanctions. Now, we were also talking about, and I wanted to flesh this out a bit more, about the fact that there's a split with Trump being clearly a great admirer of Vladimir Putin's. And then he's got people like Pompeo and so many people in his administration, Bolton, I'm talking about the newer people, but even, you know, before that, Mattis, who were very strong in terms of their criticism of Putin and of Russia. So we've got a divide there. What I'm interested in finding out from you, and I don't know, you may just have no more light to shed on this than anybody else and maybe just guessing about it, but there's been a suggestion that Trump admires Putin because Putin is maybe the richest man in the world. But also, there's been all kinds of talk about David K. Johnson, who's a big critic of Trump, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, was on this program talking about money laundering and money laundering through Russia and so forth. Manafort certainly was indicted for money laundering in Ukraine and so forth. Do you see some dots here connecting?
Well, I mean, Trump there's a few people surrounding Trump who are clearly villains. I mean, Paul Manafort, based on his everything I've read, is a very villainous character. Mike Flynn, not a good guy. A whole bunch of characters around him.
According to the head of the NSA who was on with us yesterday, who actually said Mike Flynn was a good guy and served his country and all the rest of that.
Well, he might have in the past, but what he was up to recently wasn't so good. But as far as Trump goes, nobody knows. And I think it's, everybody's got there's a lot of partisanship. There's a lot of people angry. There's a lot of Trump supporters. Nobody's looking at the truth. The truth will come out. The truth will come out absolutely clearly because Mueller, who's got the mandate to investigate and he's got the powers to investigate, he can wiretap, he can subpoena, he can interview witnesses, he can open cases against people and get them to flip as witnesses, and he will put together a case. And either there's a case that there was or there wasn't.
Well, let's assume you're right about that. But nevertheless, you already have the Trump administration, particularly now with Rudy Giuliani, using words like framing the Mueller investigations, framing Trump. The Mueller investigation is a hoax. It's a witch hunt. I mean, they've created a whole new narrative here.
Well, they can create any narrative they want. But at the end of the day, there are laws in this country and the institutions still work. And if there was a law, if the laws were broken and the prosecutor puts a case, a credible case together, then it will go through the normal system. You know, the justice system doesn't operate on the basis of sound bites. It operates on the basis of evidence and judges and juries. That's how it works.
Let me read a few comments here. Mike writes, Browder's grandfather was practically communist royalty as the head of the U.S. Communist Party until he was ousted at the end of World War II. Joe writes, did you underestimate the level of corruption when you initially began your fund? Why or why not?
So when I went into Russia, it was total, absolute chaos. In the early 1990s, it was total chaos. And my thought was that it was going to go from total chaos to like less chaos, and that it was going to go from total lawlessness to some lawfulness. And for a period of time, it actually did do that. And then the way I described Russia back then, it was a sort of wildly disorganized crime. And I thought it was all going to get sort of normalized and there'd be a regular country. But what it turned out was instead of disorganized crime, it became highly organized crime. And the person who was organizing the crime, the whole crime scheme, was Vladimir Putin. And so, yes, I completely misjudged it because I thought it was going to get better, and it actually got worse. And it got worse in a very cynical and very evil way, because imagine that the entire apparatus of the country was using all the police force and the military to commit their crimes, and that's what was going on.
Well, you know, we've done a couple of programs with former Russian Ambassador Michael McFaul, who's at Stanford now, and he says things seemed to be different when Medvedev was working with Putin and when they were kind of a dual operating government, or seemed to be under the two of them to some degree. He thought Medvedev was much more open to the West and not as hostile.
Well,
didn't have great experience with Medvedev.
Well, Medvedev was in charge when Sergei Magnitsky was murdered. So having said that, I was very unhappy with Medvedev. I think he's a crook and a bad guy, and it's been proven that he's a crook and a bad guy. But he was a lot less awful than Vladimir Putin. So, I mean, Vladimir Putin is truly he's a hugely dangerous sociopathic killer. And I don't think that Medvedev was a killer per se. I think that perhaps people would be killed during his reign, as Sergei Magnitsky was. But he wasn't going around ordering hits the way Vladimir Putin was.
Putin has been compared many times to a mafia boss. Is that an appropriate comparison?
Well, it's
a mob boss. Yeah.
It's definitely appropriate. However, every mob boss in the world would dream to have the powers of Vladimir Putin. Here's a guy who is operating as a gangster, as a killer. And he has all the powers of his law enforcement agencies and all the powers of his military. He's got nuclear weapons. It's like Pablo Escobar with nukes.
Again, Bill Browder is our guest. Beth writes, considering the poisoning of Putin critics, Litvinenko and Glushkov and others, is Bill Browder concerned for his own safety?
Well, there's two issues. Am I at high risk of being killed? The answer is yes. Do I spend my life living in fear? The answer is no. If I spent my life living in fear, they would have already accomplished 90% of their goal, because most people who are being victimized by the regime do live in fear and then don't retaliate from all the terrible things they're doing. And we are retaliating with legislation, Magnitsky legislation, all over the world. There are seven countries now that have Magnitsky acts, and we're working on another seven as we speak. And I'm not going to stop doing that out of fear.
What did you make about what went on in the Ukraine with a fake murder and essentially simulating a murder with someone who was obviously on Putin's hit list?
Well, my first reaction was, thank God he wasn't killed. His supposed murder took place the night before I was arrested in Madrid, and it really put a downer on me. And as I thought, oh God, not another Putin critic killed. And so when I learned that he was alive, for me, it was just like a total gift. And then people started criticizing them for having done this. And the answer was that this was an operation where they captured the people who wanted to kill him and the people who ordered it. And, you know, anyone who's a purist and saying, oh, this is so terrible, look, you know, that they shouldn't have done it this way. Well, I'm a purist about human life. And the fact is, the guy is alive, not dead. And the people who are going to try to kill him are in jail. And from my perspective, that's the most important conclusion from that whole episode.
You know, our intelligence offices, as I'm sure you all know, have pointed to Putin as the grand designer of the election meddling in the last campaign. And that makes perfect sense to you in your estimation of this man you've called a sociopath?
Putin absolutely meddled in these elections here. I mean, that's been proven. And it's not just here that he's meddling in elections. He meddled in the Brexit vote in the UK. He meddled in the Catalonia independence in Spain. He meddled in the French elections. He tried to get Marine Le Pen elected. He meddled in the Italian elections. Basically, Putin, he's unable to bring Russia up to the level of the West. And so his only opportunity is to try to bring the West down to his level. And it doesn't cost him that much. These interferences that they're doing, hacking and misinformation, it's very inexpensive relative to everything else everything else in his arsenal before. And he's doing this as much as he can, wherever he can, and he did it here, and he'll do it again.
How much awareness is there in Russia? I mean, you know, you talk about, give me 50%. It could have gone to the Russian people. It went to Putin's own pocket. I mean, how much are Russians themselves even cognizant of this?
Well, not so cognizant, because Putin controls every media organization. He controls every single media organization.
Yeah, but there were some izdats and there were underground kinds of things always in Russia, weren't there?
Well, so he controls all TV, all radio, and all newspapers. And to the extent that the internet is free, which is kind of not anymore, they just load up the internet with so much conflicting nonsense and nobody knows what to believe. And so if you ask a normal, intelligent Russian who is only exposed to their media, he'll believe that Putin is a patriot, not stealing, and that Putin is a good guy and he's somebody to be backed. How do you make any judgment otherwise if all your information is fake, if all of your information is a lie? And so that's why he controls it, because if anyone knew the truth, his approval ratings would drop from 88% to 1% overnight.
Well, we hear a lot about fake news from our chief executive. Wondering also, Bill, if you could tell us why you decided to become a British citizen. You were American, right?
It all comes back to my grandfather's story, which is the terrible stuff happened. You know, everyone thinks of America as being this truly sort of fair country, but it's only fair when you're not in some terrible group where they decide to turn against you. And they turned against my grandfather in the most vicious way.
This is a McCarthy era.
So my grandfather was the leader of the Communist Party of America. He had been the leader, and he was actually kicked out as leader. And they went after him, and they went after my family and his wife, my grandma.
They being FBI?
The U.S. authorities, the FBI, all the U.S. authorities. My grandmother, who had come with my grandfather from Russia to America and settled in America, became an American citizen. They decided, when they were persecuting my grandfather, that they wanted to deport her back to Russia. And they decided this while my grandmother was on her deathbed, dying of cancer. And that memory, I wasn't alive then, but the family legacy of that just made such a bad impression on me that when I was granted British citizenship, I decided that Britain has a lot more rule of law for a lot longer than America, and I was going to take that up.
You were a loving and loyal grandson despite your fact of being a rebel against your family history, huh?
Well, we have a lot of interesting emotions in our family, but loyalty to the family comes first.
Let me go to our callers, and Richard, we begin with you. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
I had a question about the Magnitsky Act. Actually, it's a question in a couple of parts. One, I think that there is some concern, I think, in the country about those who know of the Magnitsky Act and its background, about the ability of the act to survive under the Trump administration, not necessarily because of the villains who surround Trump, but the fact that if you look at Trump's business background, it's easy to have the perception that Trump has chosen to surround himself with villains.
Let me get to that. So the Magnitsky Act could there's two ways the Magnitsky Act could have passed. One is when, and this was all during the Obama administration. One was that Obama could have effectively done it by executive order with a stroke of his pen. But he didn't want to do that at the time because he had something called the Russian reset going on. He wanted to reset relations with Russia. And so he actually resisted us. And therefore, we had to go to Congress. And we went to John McCain and Senator Benjamin Cardin, Democrat and Republican. And they put through the Magnitsky Act as an act of Congress. And it passed the Senate 92-4, passed the House of Representatives 89%. And even though Obama didn't like it, he signed it into law on the 14th of December, 2012. Now, because it's an act of Congress, that means that it's unrepealable with a stroke of a pen. The only way that the Magnitsky Act could be repealed is if Trump or someone around him proposed the repeal of the Magnitsky Act. And what would their pitch be? Their pitch would be to every member of Congress that we should allow Russian torturers and murderers to come to America and use the banking system. And I know members of Congress very well, and I know them on both sides of the aisle, and there would be absolutely no support, zero support, to repeal the Magnitsky Act. And so the Magnitsky Act is here to stay. And then the question is, will the Trump administration implement the Magnitsky Act? And I was worried about that based on all of his comments, positive comments about Putin. But for whatever reason, his administration is full of Russian hawks and people like Pompeo, Nikki Haley, Jim Mattis, and others, and they've been implementing the Magnitsky Act very aggressively, and they've put on real high value targets, people who are high level people in the Putin administration, who deserve to be sanctioned and have been sanctioned. And so, I was worried, but the way that it's all playing itself out is to my expectations, 100%.
Well, it's also, I think, a credit to all the work that you've done on behalf of your former tax lawyer, that Canada and Gibraltar and Latvia and Estonia and the UK have all passed versions of the Magnitsky Act, and it's moving forward, I believe, in many Scandinavian countries and others.
Yeah. It is. And the Magnitsky Act is now sort of, I would describe it as a Magnitsky movement. Before, like last week, we had seven countries on the boil. We had Denmark, Sweden, Holland, France, Australia, South Africa, and Ukraine. And just over the last few hours, really, it looks like things are going to start up in Germany, things are going to start up in Italy, and this is something. And what happens is that politicians all over the world and all of their parliaments are watching this and saying this is clearly the tool to go after Vladimir Putin. And I should point out, by the way, that the Magnitsky Act doesn't just apply to Russia anymore; it applies to villains and bad guys everywhere.
And you have time in this crusade of yours to still manage your fund?
No. I've given up. I'm no longer a businessman. I'm 100%. I'm a human rights activist. I'm fully devoted to this cause.
And let me bring more callers aboard here. Let me go next to you, Naomi. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to ask about Mr. Browder's support for taking away funding from a Guatemalan anti-impunity commission. So it's a rather complicated story. Apparently, some anti-Putin activists were caught up in a passport fraud ring, and the Guatemalan government prosecuted them for that. But the problem is that they were supported by an anti-impunity commission, which is the only thing that's getting at grand corruption in Guatemala. And Mr. Browder has been going to the Congress and trying to take away funding on grounds that this commission is somehow supported by Vladimir Putin, for which there is absolutely no evidence. So I wonder, why do that?
Thank you for that question. It's a good question, and let me just tell the story very briefly. When I wrote my book, Red Notice, I was contacted by a family called the Bitkoff family, who had fallen out with the Putin regime when they tried to take over their timber mill in St. Petersburg. In order to try to take over their timber mill, the Putin regime kidnapped their 16-year-old daughter for 3 days. The people connected to this takeover raped her repeatedly, and then returned her to the family. And at this point, they said, "Sign over all your stuff." They basically gave up all their stuff. They fled the country, and the Putin regime kept on going after them. And they decided they picked going to Guatemala because Guatemala doesn't have an extradition treaty with Russia. So the family gets to Guatemala, and they find a law firm there to organize their immigration. They pay some money to the law firm to organize their immigration. And then the Russians track them down in Guatemala. And the Russians got this organization, UN organization called CSIG, which is supposed to be fighting impunity in Guatemala, to prosecute this family. And they sentenced the father to 19 years in jail for effectively receiving documents from a law firm for immigration, and the wife and daughter, the raped daughter, to 14 years in jail. And so I went to the Guatemalan embassy, and I said, "What's going on here?" And then I went to Congress, and I said, "Why is it that a U.S.-funded U.N. organization to fight impunity is doing Putin's bidding to put this poor family in jail for 19 years and 14 years for passport violations?" And the Guatemalan, this organization had no answer. And I've gotten this family out of jail. They're out of jail now. They were just released. And to this day, this organization is trying to keep them in jail. And so I don't know what's going on in this organization. I can prove with documentary evidence that the Russians have influenced this organization. It's nonsense to say that the Russians have nothing to do with this organization. And I believe in fighting impunity as much as the next one. But if the guy in charge of this organization is on the Russian payroll, then he should be dismissed and another person should come into this organization and run it properly.
And let me thank Naomi for her inquiry and call. And let me go to some comments that are coming in from listeners. Ben says, "Is there any way to change the kleptocracy in Russia short of some kind of a coup?"
It's
a heavy question.
Well, I mean, you know, people say, what's the good news? Where's the good news? You know, where's the positive news? The answer is that while Putin is in power, it's going to get worse. And just understand Putin's motivations. He's stolen, in my estimation, $200 billion from the Russian state during his reign. And he wants to keep that money. And the only way he can keep that money is if he stays in power. And the only way he can stay in power is if he runs one of these sort of dictatorships. And so he's going to continue to do bad stuff. People are going to continue to be upset with him outside. There are going to continue to be sanctions. And as it gets worse, it's going to get worse for all of us. And I don't see how the kleptocracy ends, and I don't see how goodness for the Russians come until this guy is out of power.
Plus, there's no, I mean, it reminds me of so many of these autocratic regimes. There's no force that seems to be pushing against Putin or have the velocity and the necessity that is required for that to push against. I mean, the elections are a farce in Russia, and there's really no opposition. There's no heir apparent even.
Well, there's no opposition because Putin kills them, imprisons them, or exiles them. He killed my friend Boris Nemtsov, who was a very popular character, opposition politician. They put in jail Alexei Navalny and his brother, and they exiled Garry Kasparov. And so there's no democracy in Russia. It's a dictatorship, and it's going to be a dictatorship until either Putin dies of natural causes, gets overthrown, or gets assassinated.
Well, here's Kurt, who writes, "From my perspective, it appears Russia did what other countries legitimately do, such as advertise and promote their national point of view, snooping through Facebook and social media. So did they actually do anything new?" And when we had James Clapper on earlier this week, you know, there were pretty much accounted for hundreds of examples of the United States meddling in other elections, which I'm sure you're mindful of.
Well,
so what do you say to that argument that Kurt has just put forward here, the way he's framed it, that this is what countries do, especially powerful countries?
Well, I guess the answer is that do powerful countries go around the world assassinating their critics? Do powerful countries go around the world committing grave financial crimes? Do powerful countries go around the world cheating in the Olympics? Do powerful countries in the world go around shooting down passenger jets over Ukraine? Do powerful countries go around bombing women and children in Syria? I mean, Russia is a very bad actor, and to say other people are bad actors, that justifies it, I think.
Yeah, I can hear somebody critical of the United States going right to some of the points you just raised.
Well, that's called whataboutism.
Yeah.
And the United States is a highly flawed country with all sorts of problems, but it's a flawed country that has some mechanisms to unflaw it. And people can be, voted out of power. There's lots of, in Illinois, which was my home state, there's like so many governors that are in jail. You lose count. Why? Because the system works. Were they corrupt? Yep. Did they go to jail? Yes.
But you had abuses of power even in your own personal history, and you see abuses of power. Certainly, they can characterize as such right now.
And we should address those abuses of power, but it doesn't mean we should forgive Russia for what they're doing.
We'll bring another caller aboard here, and that's you, Neil. Good morning.
Yeah, two questions. First, what were your parents' reactions to Khrushchev's secret speech and Orwell and Arthur Kessler? Did they remain loyal communists even after they were expelled? The second question is, has anybody ever put together a list of the number of Putin opponents who have been killed?
Well, I could start rattling it off, but it would take for the rest of the show to rattle off.
Maybe into the evening. Sorry.
So many people have been killed. I don't know about your first question. You sound more educated than I am on the...
Maybe I'll reframe that for you, Neil, if you permit me. I mean, there were many. Your parents were of the generation that found really what was going on in the gulags and what Stalin was doing and so forth. And there were many really ardent communists who turned away from Russia after that.
Well, it's an excellent question and something that so my grandfather died when I was 9 years old. And so I knew him as Grandpa with, the guy with white hair and his study smelled like pipe smoke. And so I never knew him as a, person I could talk to, but I ask the same question myself right now, which is, what does he think about all? What did he think about the purges and the gulags and so on? Because I could easily imagine if we would have a very strong disagreement today if there was any argument that he made that supported that.
John wants to know: can Mr. Browder explain how the investment vehicle he designed was monetized, and if that money ended up with Putin?
So my investment vehicle was a mutual fund. It was an investment fund, like a Fidelity fund or whatever. And we bought shares in Russian companies, big companies like Gazprom and Lukoil and various other big Russian companies. And the way we made money was by buying shares, hopefully at a low price, and then selling them at a higher price.
You were capitalizing on the oil industry in Russia to a great extent.
And other industries. And we basically bought shares and sold shares and then took the profits and brought them home. Thankfully, Putin didn't get any of that money. However, the $230 million of taxes that we paid to the Russian government, which was stolen from the Russian government, we've traced some of that money to a guy who's a trustee of Vladimir Putin. There's a famous story that came out of the Panama Papers about a cellist who's worth $2 billion.
Yeah.
His name is Sergei Roldugin. And Sergei Roldugin, he's a close personal friend of Putin from childhood. He's the godfather of Putin's daughters. And Sergei Roldugin got some of that money, and that means Putin got some of that money.
Speaking of Putin's daughters, you don't hear much about Putin's progeny or his family. They're kind of kept in the shadows.
Well, because in Russia, they will kill anybody who talks about them, and so it's not a very popular subject among journalists.
We go to Joan next. Joan, join us.
Yes, I'm just asking an obvious question, but I know that Trump, we all know that Trump admires Putin maybe above anyone. And I just wonder how much power similar to Putin's do you think Trump could actually take? So much in this country seems to be on the honor system that there are a lot of loopholes for tyranny, I think. I just wondered what you think about that.
Well, I actually am much more optimistic about America than most of my – I mean, I've been outside of America, so I look at it from a distance. I live in London, and I've lived there for 29 years. But I'm actually pretty optimistic about the institutions of America. If you watch what's happening here, any attempt to do anything bad is immediately exposed. I mean, just for example, the whole Trump Tower meeting about the Magnitsky Act, that got exposed by the New York Times. And then I spent the entire 3 months from last summer, like talking to every journalist that ever wanted to talk about it as they delved into it. And so, you know, the press is free here. The press is doing its job. The courts are working. You know, when he wanted to do the
Trump is battling both, though. Constantly.
He's battling them, but you know what? He's not winning. And Congress also works. You know, they took away his power to lift sanctions on Russia. It was voted 98-2 in Congress. And so, I mean, you know, stuff happens that is not very pleasant, and we're all watching it and not feeling good about it. But I would say that the system as it was designed kind of works here, and it seems to be holding up pretty well, compared to other countries. If you look at Turkey and Hungary and places where they have autocrats who are all changing their constitutions and doing all sorts of terrible stuff, this country is holding up a lot better.
Quick question with seconds left. Rob wants to know, how would you like the U.S. to deal with Russia at this time, and what would you tell Mr. Trump?
Well, I'd say that Trump should not be praising Vladimir Putin. He's a terrible sociopathic killer, and the United States needs to contain Russia and contain Putin.
We'll leave it there. Thank Bill Browder. Good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Bill Browder, again, a CEO of Hermitage Capital Management, now a full-time human rights activist, and we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Thank you for listening, and thank you for being a part of this morning's program. We'll be back with you if all goes according to plan on tomorrow. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.